welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Our program today, we look at the phenomenon how few Americans are aware that the U.S. support enabled creation of the modern state of Israel. Even fewer know that U.S. politicians pushed this policy over the forceful objections of top diplomatic and military experts. Today, we'll interview author and scholar Allison Weir regarding her new book, Against Our Better Judgment, The Hidden History of How the United States Was Used to Create Israel. For the second half of the show, we'll look at recent developments regarding Edward Snowden and the corporate media and political establishment propaganda attempts to frame leakers and journalists as traitors. And we end the show in discussion about academic freedom. We'll talk with Aaron Good, a PhD student at Temple University, where there was a controversial dismissal of the African-American Studies Associate Professor, Anthony Montero. Our first guest is Allison Weir. We're going to be speaking with her about her new book, Against Our Better Judgment, The Hidden History of How the United States Was Used to Create Israel. And here is Peter Phillips to introduce Allison. Peter?
Allison Weir is the author of Against Our Better Judgment, The Hidden History of How the United States Was Used to Create Israel. This was published in February of 2014. Allison, in 2001, she went to Israel and really has been writing ever since about the struggle between Palestinians and Israel. She left her job as editor of a weekly newspaper, traveled alone to the Palestinian territory. She has since widely written on Israel-Palestine, the U.S. connections, media coverage. Her essays and articles have appeared in a number of books and magazines. She was in our censored 2005 yearbook. She's written in the Washington Report on the Middle East, San Francisco Bay Viewed Counterpunch, and a number of others. Allison, are you with us?
Yes, I am. Thank you for having me on the show.
Yeah, great to have you. It's been a while since we've seen you. Now, tell us about this book you've just got out. Why did you write this book, and what is the hidden history of the United States relative to the creation of Israel?
Well, I wrote the book because, as you mentioned, like most Americans, I had not previously known much about the issue of Israel-Palestine. When I finally woke up in fall of 2000 and traveled there myself as an independent journalist and saw what was going on and really the violent oppression of the indigenous population there, the Palestinian Muslim and Christians, I became very involved back in, you know, early 2001. At that time, I began reading books about this issue to try to learn more about it, in addition to visiting the region and interviewing people. And I was especially curious about the U.S. connection to Israel, why we have this, quote, special relationship, really unlike any other, where we give Israel more of our tax money than any other nation on earth, and we shield it, we veto international resolutions regarding it in the UN Security Council, for example. So I was especially curious about the U.S. connection and started reading books about it in 2001. And I just read book after book, and I would look at the footnotes to see where the information was coming from to make sure it was reliable. Then I would often order those books, because these days with Amazon you can get long out of print books, and was discovering an astounding history of the U.S. connected to Israel and how we were basically manipulated into supporting Israel, and it was that support that allowed the Zionists to create this modern nation state. So in the past years, I've realized that I knew aspects about this issue that almost nobody else seemed to know. You know, I think just because I've focused so much on learning about that I finally decided I should write an article with this information for people. And in writing the article, there was so much to cover that I ended up realizing it had to be a book. I still have purposely kept it a fairly short book that can be read very quickly. Half the book are citations, endnotes, so that people can see exactly where I got my information. And it contains still additional details that I think are often very interesting. But certainly the main text of the book can be read easily in a weekend, probably shorter than that. So my goal was just to get this information out to people that almost no one seemed to know about.
Allison, one of the issues, of course, that comes up right away on this topic is people that say they're critical of Israel are anti-Semitic. And you can certainly be critical of a government's policy. You can certainly talk about Zionism as a historical movement going back over 100 years to create the State of Israel without being anti-Semitic. And so I'm careful to, you know, frame that in that context, that we are looking at these issues very objectively, that we want to take a look at the history and talk a little bit about the history of Zionism and the origins of the desire to have an independent Jewish state.
That's right. Well, you know, it is a tactic that's used to try to discredit anybody that's giving facts about Israel and about Zionism that adherents of that ideology don't want people to know. So you call them names. You know, if you can't attack the message, and mine is very factual, then you try to attack the messenger. You know, I have a long life history. I'm not young, so I have a long life history of opposing bigotry of every sort. It's an attack that has no substance to it, but, you know, it's what they do with anybody that talks about this issue. It turns out that the Zionist movement in the United States began in the late 1800s, which was shocking to me because here I grew up in this country, as did my parents, and yet there was a very important political movement within my country called Zionism. It's an ideology, and adherents are called Zionists, and yet I was not aware of that at all until, you know, 14 years ago when I started to look into this issue. So like most Americans, I could not have told you what Zionist meant, what Zionism was. You know, I suspect I'd heard those terms. You know, if somebody asked me, what is a Zionist, what is Zionism, I'm guessing my answer would have been, well, let me think. I think I've heard of that term. What is it? You know, and yet it's had a major impact at beginning in the late 1800s. By the 1910s, there were already 20,000 Zionists in the United States, often in large cities on the East Coast in particular, where they already were having an impact on Congress. Congressional representatives were already listening to these Zionists in formulating decisions, so they were already significant. You know, around the turn of the last century, the Zionist movement was quite active in the U.S.
So at that time, there were some rather famous Americans closely involved. As the movement grew, there was some, according to your book, with 20,000 adherents. And all over the world, they were looking for, the movement was looking for locations to perhaps have a Jewish state. And it wasn't just automatically selecting Palestine. And who were some of the famous Americans that were involved 100 years ago? And what happened? How did Israel ultimately become the targeted area to create a Jewish state?
Well, the most prominent one and very, very significant person who was a Zionist in the United States, and this really did happen 100 years ago, was Louis Brandeis. In 1914, he became a Zionist. And in fact, the World Zionist Movement, which had been in Europe, moved to the United States under the leadership of Louis Brandeis, who then in 1916 became a Supreme Court Justice. He was a close associate of Woodrow Wilson. This was very significant because Brandeis is a very important Supreme Court Justice. I'm sure most of us could only name a few Supreme Court justices of the past century, but Louis Brandeis is one of the ones many of us would know about. Well, he was the head of World Zionism, but then when he became a Supreme Court justice, ethics required him and political pressure required him to resign his affiliations. You're supposed to be a neutral arbiter of justice when you're a judge. So he officially resigned his leadership of the Zionist organization, but secretively, he stayed in charge of it. So his loyal lieutenant would come to him in his Supreme Court chambers, report to him on their activities to push this Zionist agenda. He would give them directives about what next to do and how to carry out this movement right from the Supreme Court chambers. This is astounding as this may be to some listeners. It was certainly astounding to me. This is written about in quite a few books. It's really surprisingly known among some historians, although most of the rest of us have never known that. I found that extremely surprising that a Supreme Court justice was doing such a thing. And, of course, it was highly unethical to do it. That's why he did it secretly. Then, however, I discovered something even more shocking to me from a very mainstream book by an author named Peter Gross. It's called, his book is called Israel in the Mind of America. It was published by Knopf, a major, you know, establishment publisher. Gross himself had been the diplomatic correspondent for the New York Times. He was at Harvard University. He wrote a number of other well-regarded nonfiction books about history, and is considered an expert. He's not at all fringe or certainly not political, if anything, probably somewhat conservative. He does tilt towards Israel, I would say. And in his book, he told even more about Brandeis. He wrote that Brandeis was the leader of a secret society called the Parashim that pushed Zionism throughout the United States and also had connections, worldwide connections, especially to Britain. I was shocked to read that, especially in a book of that sort where you expect the information to be well supported with facts. So I looked at his footnote to see where he had gotten that information and then went to that source, which turned out to be a scholarly journal called the American Jewish Historical Quarterly. It had an article in 1975 called The Parashim, a Secret Episode in American Zionist History. It was authored by Dr. Sarah Schmidt, who's an Israeli professor. She's at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. She's since that time written a book that has a whole chapter about the Parashim. And what Gross and Schmidt write about is pretty astounding. That Brandeis and others, the founder of the Parashim was Horace Cowan, who was a professor at the University of Wisconsin. And they had this society that would, where the members of it had secret rituals in which they were inducted into membership. They spread out across the United States. This is a quote from Gross saying their interests in Zionism were kept alive by secretive exchanges. They underwent a secret induction ceremony in which they were told, quote, "Until our purpose shall be accomplished, you will be fellow of a brotherhood whose bond you will regard as greater than any other in your life, dearer than that of family, of school, of nation," unquote. This is a Supreme Court justice. This isn't something he did as a fraternity boy. This was when he was a sitting Supreme Court justice.
Now, Brandeis also was involved in getting Frankfurter on the Supreme Court. Chief Justice Frankfurter, but Frankfurter was also closely working with him, originally through the university and then directly in this, I would say, Jewish lobby. I'm always careful when we say a secret society, because secret societies exist all over the place. And these are networks of people that like to do private things, and whether it's a Masonic lodge or whatever, that's certainly true. But what we're really looking at here is a very public lobby for a state of Israel, a Jewish state that existed over 100 years ago and had been acceptable in the direction for many people at the highest levels in the United States.
This was, as you say, on some levels, this is a very public lobby. You know, now it's called the Israel lobby. Before Israel existed, it was called a Zionist lobby. There was, for example, the American Zionist Emergency Council. So some of it was and is very public. I don't think it's very widely known, except for those of us that really focus on it. But it is very public. But many of its activities, on the other hand, were intentionally, and again, they wrote about this in documents that are now available to us. So these different Zionist organizations sometimes even had annual reports and memos and documents that wrote about their intentions, and often they were to do it secretly. So the fact that Brandeis was a member of this very institutionalized network was kept secret was because it would have been considered improper, because as one of the members of it wrote, if people knew what we were doing, we wouldn't succeed, basically. You know, you have to do this secretively if you're going to succeed, was what they wrote, and that's why they kept it secret.
We're speaking with Allison Weir, author most recently of Against Our Better Judgment, The Hidden History of How the United States Was Used to Create Israel. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with Peter Phillips, and this is the Project Censored show on Pacifica Radio. Allison, sorry to interrupt you there. Just had to do a quick station ID and also remind our listeners who you were and what we were discussing. And if we could just go back a moment, could you at least very briefly define what is meant literally by the term Zionism or Zionist? And could you also talk about how then the Zionist movement and Zionism in general cross-pollinates with Christianity and how that alliance formed as we go through World War II to talk about the creation of the State of Israel?
Sure. Zionism is a movement to create a Jewish state. It's a fairly simple dictionary definition. So it's a political movement to create a Jewish state. A Zionist is an adherent of that ideology. It's an ideology and a movement to achieve the ideology. A Zionist is, you know, like a socialist is an adherent of socialism, and that's what a Zionist is. It's a political ideology movement. There are religious forms of it, but in general, it's political, and these early Zionist leaders were not at all religious. In fact, for many decades, the majority of religious Jews, in fact, the majority of Jewish Americans and the majority of Jews around the world were not Zionists. Most of them did not agree with it. Many were actively anti-Zionist and actively opposed to it. So I think it's important to understand those roots were very secular. And they did consider it. It quickly became a movement to create a Jewish state in Palestine. But there was a period of time when the father of the Zionist movement, named Theodor Herzl, considered other places. He considered Uganda, Argentina they looked at. There were some other locations that were considered. So Herzl himself was very happy when the British said, well, we're not, you know, they weren't in favor of Palestine, but they said you could have something in what was, I believe, then called Uganda. I think the area is actually part of Kenya now. So this was a very fringe, very fervent movement in the world and in the United States, even though it started to have many people that were part of it for many decades. It was opposed by the U.S. establishment. The State Department was against Zionism, saying it was very had nothing to do with the U.S., would actually hurt our strategic needs in the region. They wrote many memos and studies and reports by the State Department, by the Pentagon, by intelligence agencies, all recommending against supporting Zionism. And one of the first ones was in 1912, under President Taft. The State Department opposed it. And decade after that, they wrote, Dean Acheson wrote that it would imperil not only American interests, but it would hurt all Western interests in the Near East. So this was very opposed by governmental officials who were not vulnerable to lobbying. Now, political officials, as we know, congressmen and presidents, have one shared goal, which is to win the next election. So early on, many political figures in the U.S. were supporting Zionism because of, you know, wishing to get reelected. And in the case of Truman and Dewey, the very close presidential election, they both were going after the Zionist movement, donations, and media access, and the vote in critical states such as New York. So for that reason, just as we see today, but early on, political leaders in the U.S. were often caving into what Zionists wanted, quite often reluctantly. In fact, almost always it was reluctant. But they did it.
I noticed in your book, too, that you list how, starting back 100 years ago, that the ambassador to Turkey was always Jewish.
That's right.
For decades. And that was almost seen as a Jewish position. Of course, that was the Ottoman Empire, which did, in fact, at that time, control Palestine. And so one of the ideas was that a Jewish ambassador would help pave the way for a Jewish state in Palestine.
That's right. Presidents realized that the Zionists in the U.S., and they often equated Zionists with Jews in general. The Ottoman Empire was very important to them. So it became, as a Jewish historian, who's Jewish himself and a historian of Jewish history in the U.S., said that the ambassadorship was basically a, quote, quasi-Jewish domain. That continued. It began in 1887, and it continued until after World War I, when the Ottoman Empire was defeated. That's the only reason that it, probably the only reason it ended. That's
following your book, it's certainly clear that World War II, of course, and the Holocaust and the terribleness of that led a number of people in the U.S. to be, to Jewish people and Christians, to support the creation of a state of Israel. And that was part of the movement then that, that really expanded in a much larger way at the highest political levels, even though at the time the State Department was strongly opposed to a state of Israel. So did you talk a little bit about not only the merger of Christianity and Zionism, but also how the real formation happened right after World War II?
Sure, as you're that's very correct. That it was the Nazis and World War II and the atrocities that people learned were happening is, of course, that's what really gave the final successful impetus to Zionists to create a Jewish state in Palestine, because they were very much exploited the sympathy toward Jews, that the very legitimate sympathy that people around the world had for Jews, for what was being done against them. So that's when the Jewish population of the U.S., which, as I said previously, the majority were not Zionists, during those years in the 40s, that's when the transition changed. And the Zionists made that happen to a degree, because there were efforts. It turns out, again, we don't often hear about this, but there were efforts to help Jewish refugees in a number of cases. FDR was trying to push that. And they were sabotaged by Zionists who wanted there to be only one safe harbor for Jews, that it would be in Palestine, where they would create a Jewish state. And they were worried that if Jews could live elsewhere safely, as of course they did, which is why most Jews elsewhere were saying, wait, we're Americans, we're British, we don't want another Jewish, another state somewhere. But then with World War, you know, during the Nazis, the Zionists could say, see, we have to have a Jewish state specifically created. It has to be in Palestine, so there's a safe harbor for Jews. And so these efforts that FDR and Morris Ernst was his delegate under him, specifically having conferences and making efforts to put together refugee efforts around the world that would have helped European Jews, were sabotaged, because then it would show, that would minimize, would sort of decrease the effectiveness of the argument that there has to be a Jewish state somewhere.
Well, Allison,
so they sabotaged those.
Allison, we're, so you also write that, you know, there's obviously Zionist colonialization efforts in Palestine, and this happens through the UN. But what is also interesting to note, as far as the historical record and things that are completely expunged from the corporate media accounts and most government official accounts when anything like Israel-Palestine comes up in the present, is that the U.S. State Department opposed the partition plan for Palestine. Then in 1947, the Central Intelligence Agency, brand spanking new at the time, said that this was not a good idea, not a good idea for U.S. interests, not a good idea for the region, not a good idea in the strategic interests of Western powers in the near and the Middle East. So it's interesting to go back and note that there was a lot of opposition at the time.
That's right. They were, as you say, they were saying it was not good for U.S. interests. It would hurt our strategic interests. As the Cold War was starting to get in place, one of the major people who was involved in the Cold War said this will help, you know, this will hurt us because it will drive the Arabs into the Russian arms, et cetera. So they were fervently arguing against supporting Zionism during the, before the partition plan, and then during the push for the partition plan. You have these many memos from the CIA, from the different national security agencies, from various diplomats, from Roy Henderson. Kennan was writing against it. You know, there's a massive amount of evidence that this was not being pushed by U.S. interest. All the experts were saying this would hurt U.S. interest. Now, I didn't get to the question earlier, and I don't know if we still have time, but...
We have about 3 minutes left.
Okay. Well, the Christian population, again, was also not originally Zionist, but what happened is there was a great deal of effort to recruit American Christians, as there was an effort to recruit American Jews, both to embrace Zionism as, you know, different tactics, different used with different demographics within the U.S. Every sector of the U.S. was targeted very effectively. Christian clergy were targeted, business was targeted, labor, congressmen, media, professors. There were memos specifically describing how to target them, how to go after Christians.
Allison, you also write about how this is not just going on in the United States, but the UK. You talk about Rabbi Korf and Reginald Gilbert. We don't have too much time to get into all these stories. Certainly, people should likely pick up a copy of your book, Against Our Better Judgment, The Hidden History of How the United States Was Used to Create Israel. But given we do only have about a minute and a half left in this segment, can you at least wrap up for us in a conclusive way? What are you trying to achieve with this work of yours?
But what I feel is, you know, it's essential to understand history if you're going to have a successful present and future. And I end with a quote from George Orwell, which is, you know, he who controls the present controls the past, and he who controls the past controls the future. The way things are going now, this is not a good future. The present is extremely bad in Palestine, as I'm sure your listeners know. The U.S. support of Israel is what makes that all possible, this massive economic and diplomatic support. And we need to know the history of what led to that. I think once we know the history, it makes it more effective and more possible for us to reexamine our policies and to implement much more rational policies rather than ones that are just creating more and more violence and conflict and are tragic for the region and extremely dangerous for Americans.
Well, Allison Weir, you end by saying perhaps by rediscovering the past, we'll gain control of the present and save the future. And that's Against Our Better Judgment, The Hidden History of How the United States Was Used to Create Israel. We've been speaking with Allison Weir. Allison Weir, thanks so much for joining us on the Project Censored show today.
Thank you so much.
Do you have a website? Do you have a website to give out where people can learn more?
There's a website, againstourbetterjudgment.org, that tells about the book more, tells reviews, and tells where my different speaking engagements around the area.
Okay, thanks, Allison Weir. After a short musical break, Peter and I will be back to talk about the ongoing surveillance state escapades involving Edward Snowden, Glenn Greenwald, and much more. Please stay with us on the Project Censored show. Listening to the Project Censored show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Peter and I are going to, for the next segment here today, we're going to talk about the Edward Snowden interview on NBC. We're going to talk about some of John Kerry's remarks, Daniel Ellsberg, the famous whistleblower from the Pentagon Papers, retort to those. And of course, we're going to talk about it under the guise of what the role of a free press is alleged to be or ought to be versus what it is and what it's really turned into, particularly in the United States. Later in the program, we'll be talking to Aaron Good about academic freedom and the case of the firing of African-American studies professor Anthony Montero. So please stick with us for that. But now, Peter, let's talk a little bit about this. Glenn Greenwald, of course, has a new book called No Place to Hide, Edward Snowden, the NSA, and the U.S. Surveillance State. Project Censored, we've long talked about the police state and the surveillance state. Let's get this started here. Of course, Snowden has been really the focus of a lot of the discussion about the national security state. And the way that the corporate media has framed this is it's somehow about Snowden. Is he a hero? Is he a traitor? We heard the same things about Chelsea Manning case. There's a tendency to really target the individuals, to shoot the messenger here, when in fact what we should be doing is paying attention to what these individuals are actually leaking and the wrongdoings and criminality that they may be exposing. Peter?
Well, certainly the corporate media in the United States has been lining up to condemn Edward Snowden and ignore Julian Assange. In many ways, the coverage of Snowden is a complete dismissal of Julian Assange. In fact, Michael Kinsley in the Sunday Book Review, where he's reviewing Glenn Greenwald, he calls a narcissist like Julian Assange, founder of WikiLeaks. It's not just a dismissal. And so understanding that. And then, but the interview itself on NBC was historical, and that it did, in fact, allow Edward to talk about some of the things that were really important to him. Like, I have no relationship with the Russian government at all. I mean, he said he's never met Putin. He's nothing there. He just simply got stuck there because the U.S. pulled his passport when he happened to be in Moscow. He also said that many of the things the government says today simply aren't true, and that he found that out because he was national security. He worked for NSA, worked for CIA. He was working for private contractors. And he just simply saying the American people are being misled and lied to. And that he felt that it was important to do that. So he says, I'm still working for the government. I'm a patriot. I'm trying to tell the American people what the government is doing. And he defines the security state, one that prioritized security all over all other considerations. So, you know, our Bill of Rights, due process, security state becomes the number one priority, and everything else is sort of dismissed. And he said that right is not always the same as legal. So he was saying that he believed that what he did was morally right, that he was exposing this intense security state, and that, it may be illegal. He's been charged with crimes that could get him 30 years in prison. I wouldn't be very anxious to leave Moscow either if you were faced with solitary confinement for the rest of your life.
And it's true. And Secretary of State John Kerry, in some bluster and bravado, used the terminology that Edward Snowden needed to, quote, man up. You know, I recall back in the Bush, W. Bush years, you know, liberals would mock such bravado and such nonsensical talk when Bush would say things like wanted dead or alive and these kinds of statements. You know, they're really anti-intellectual in so many ways. And John Kerry's taunting of Snowden to return to the United States to get a fair trial. Daniel Ellsberg writes recently in the Guardian newspaper that Snowden would not get a fair trial and that Kerry's wrong. In fact, there's in fact very little chance at all that Snowden would be getting any kind of a fair trial. In fact, Daniel Ellsberg writes, because John Kerry actually cited Daniel Ellsberg as a hero in his talk, and Ellsberg, of course, takes issue with this, and you know says that Snowden is one of the greatest patriot whistleblowers of our time. He knows what I learned more than four decades ago. Until the Espionage Act gets reformed, he can never come home safe and receive justice. And as far as the political class, Peter King, John Kerry, Republicans, Democrats, certainly the corporate news media, NBC in the interview, they're framing this entire thing as if it is a debate about heroism and whether or not this person's a traitor. They're ignoring most of what is being leaked in lieu of it. And they're also doing a lot of shooting the messenger. Michael Kinsley's piece, reviewing Greenwald's book, No Place to Hide, is a pretty great case study in how this establishment propaganda works to attack the messenger. And, I mean, they're almost in uniform lockstep here. There's a great piece also written by Barry Eisler. It was published on the Freedom of the Press Foundation website, pressfreedomfoundation.org, from May 27. And Barry Eisler goes through and looks at what all these major journalists, quote-unquote, or sick in brackets, say. Jonathan Alter said, if you missed the Michael Kinsley's review of Greenwald, one of the biggest jerks in journalism, even if partly right. I mean, this is kind of an amazing talk here. But I mean, you know, Kinsley basically says that when it comes to what the press should publish, quote, that decision must ultimately be made by the government, and that journalists who don't toe the government line might need to be locked up. This is Michael Kinsley, who's allegedly, you know, this journalist, this peer, this person that is This person that, you know, is revered as a journalist, an establishment journalist, which is pretty amazing, who's literally attacking. He's attacking Greenwald, claiming that people should be locked up. And then if you take a look at Jonathan Chait, Michael Kinsley deftly fillets Greenwald. Jeffrey Goldberg, talks about this, saying, George Packer was right on subject. And Packer just continues this line. David Gregory, who had the audacity to ask Glenn Greenwald if he was a real journalist when interviewing him, said that this is a great addition to the debate. This is pretty amazing. All of these folks are lining up. All of these CNBC, Washington Post, Newsweek, all these people are lining up right behind lockstep with Michael Kinsley to attack Glenn Greenwald and also use that as an attack against Edward Snowden.
But also to say that Snowden acknowledged that when he released the materials to Greenwald, he was emphatic that nothing be released that would in fact hurt somebody or expose somebody who might be doing undercover work in a foreign country. But
you mean like how they just did in Afghanistan the other day when they allegedly inadvertently
exactly.
released the name of the CIA agent in Kabul?
And then he goes on to say that it's the government that decide what should be released, not Glenn Greenwald. And, you know, that's the problem. If the government decides what should be released, nothing will be released. And Snowden is saying we're being lied to daily. And, so Kinsley is saying that Greenwald is a criminal, that he should, in fact, be indicted as well, that anybody that exposes government information is a criminal. And from our perspective and from a perspective of a democratic America, we need that exposure. We need to know what's happening at the highest levels in our government. And that's a vital piece, this information that's coming out, but it's not coming out. That's part of the problem.
And of course, at Project Censored, one of the big goals is that we don't believe that there should be any censorship. And now some folks will argue that there's this classification issue. Well, there's state secrets and classification and so on. But in the rise of the surveillance state, especially after 9/11, you know, we've had a rebirth and regrowth of COINTELPRO. And we saw that in the Occupy movement, and the FBI basically had to say, oh, well, yeah, people were targeting Occupy leaders and so on. Yet they, out of the other side of their mouth, they act like there's nothing we should be worried about. You know, it's as if it's a Star Wars moment where the state is saying, these aren't the droids you're looking for. Nothing to see here. But we know that when James Clapper testified last spring in Congress about how the NSA was not collecting this data and was not doing this, and then that was one of the things that prompted Edward Snowden to leak these documents to Glenn Greenwald after he tried to go through the chain of command. That's another one of the criticisms here. It's like, well, he should go through the chain of command. Well, what chain of command will he go through when his superiors make public statements that directly contradict the facts? It's unreasonable to suspect. Look at John Kiriakou at the CIA, who went to his superiors, and now he's sitting in jail for 3 years because he outed CIA torture. The lesson is clear here, that these people are not going to go through the chain of command when that chain of command is connected to an apparatus of global hegemony, the U.S. NATO empire, that is trying to keep these things under wraps. And the corporate media's role is to attack the messengers and infinitely distract people with nonsensical issues. And, you know, the idea that somehow we're not supposed to believe that Snowden says he emailed these people. That's the next claim that comes out of the NBC interviews, is that somehow when Snowden says, well, look, there's emails where I tried to go through the channels and they didn't say it, then NBC goes back to the NSA and says, well, where's these emails? And the NSA says, oh, we only have one, and Edward Snowden didn't say anything about it. Somehow we're supposed to believe an agency that lied for over a decade about the fact that they were even surveilling in this fashion. Somehow we're supposed to believe a corrupted telecom and corporate news media that were sharing illegally data with the U.S. government and, in fact, had to get retroactive immunity through Congress for breaking the law. And by the way, candidate Barack Obama returned from his campaign trail to break a campaign promise to vote to give telecom immunity. And then we found out, too, that the Bush White House asked the New York Times to sit on the AT&T spy story for over a year. At what point is any reasonable person exercising sound judgment going to go through the proper channels when they know that the information is not going to get to the public or get to, and that's the last check and balance here, folks. The Fourth Estate is dead. The public is it. We need to try to engage in the public in this capacity so that people understand the gross level of criminality that is taking place at the federal level.
I think Abby Mark had good comments on breaking the set on RT, where she really said, okay, this is a real cover-up, a dismissal of the information that has been coming out from Snowden. But also, none of that information is really covered as news. So she says, where's the content? Why does the corporate media just hide this? We want to know what's in this information. We also want Glenn Greenwald to start releasing this on a massive scale. We want to know what's been spying has been happening. We want to know every country in the world want to know how they've been manipulated and how their opposition parties have been funded by the U.S. And the covert activities that are going on and how everybody in the world is being monitored and listened to and these massive computer programs that correlate where you are and what you say simultaneously and just completely unload on all of us so that we're all spied on, we're all watched, we're all, you know, incapable of knowing the degree to which all that's happening and we're being manipulated.
And we saw most recently, just in the last couple months, the Senator Dianne Feinstein, who has essentially never met a surveillance plan that she seemed to disagree with, until the CIA got busted spying on her Senate committee to oversee them. And then there was vitriol and outrage like we've seen never before on the matter of surveillance, right? And I, you know, Greenwald starts his book out this way, and I agree with you, Peter. And Abby Martin, by the way, who's a board member with us at Media Freedom Foundation, and Project Censored, I think did a great job of calling attention to that. We've long at Project Censored said we should pay attention to the content, not the personalities. And we think there's a lot of information here that we still need to be going over and dealing with rather than focusing on these people, these characters. But Greenwald starts his book out in a really historically interesting way, going back to the Church Committee, Senator Frank Church in 1975. And this is more true now than then. Church said, "The United States government has perfected a technological capability that enables us to monitor the message that goes through the air. That capability at any time could be turned around on the American people, and no American would have any privacy left, such as the capability to monitor everything, telephone conversations, telegrams, it doesn't matter. There would be no place to hide." And Senator Frank Church, of course, today would say the internet, our phones, microphones on streets and cameras that pick up sound on street corners and so forth. I mean, this is Big Brother's bigger brother on steroids, essentially. And we're supposed to be just accepting all this without any real debate or oversight. And again, the only outrage we've seen on any real level is coming when the Senate finds out that the CIA isn't cooperating with them and is in fact spying on them about their own surveillance activities and torture activities and so on. So it certainly gets a bit Orwellian and Kafkaesque on multiple levels, but we'd certainly like to encourage our listeners to check out Glenn Greenwald's new book, check out Abby Martin, Breaking the Set, read Dan Ellsberg's new piece in The Guardian. Stay abreast with this stuff, folks, and you know, certainly be talking about it. Bring up these issues. That's the way we do it. In a community radio, we try to help with that dialogue and that conversation. So, again, you're listening to the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Helf with Peter Phillips. After this short musical break, we're going to return and talk about academic freedom. We'll be joined by PhD student Aaron Good at Temple University, and we'll be talking about the dismissal of African American Studies professor Dr. Anthony Montero. Please stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. In the final segment of our program today, the Project Censored Show, we are going to be in discussion with Aaron Good. Aaron is a PhD student at Temple University in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And we're talking about the case of Dr. Anthony Montero. Anthony Montero was associate professor, a non-tenured associate professor, an outspoken professor, the best kind in Peter and my estimation, who, well, seemingly was targeted and dismissed. And there are many folks that have been chiming in for the call for the reinstatement of Dr. Anthony Montero. And it's an impressive list, folks. Angela Davis, Cornell West, Chris Hedges. There's a lot of Vijay Prasad, a lot of people here calling for this. Certainly, those of us that support academic freedom are calling for it. And our caller here, Aaron Good, we have on the line. Aaron, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Aaron Good, please give our listeners a quick background on the Anthony Montero case at Temple.
Sure. Anthony Montero has been an associate professor of African American studies at Temple University, and he left a job where he had tenure elsewhere and was promised tenure at the time that he came to Temple. And since he has been there, he has been a very dedicated scholar, publishing many, many articles, focusing on W.E.B. Du Bois. Additionally, he is more active than just about any professor I know of at Temple in terms of engaging with the community and the very often neglected and marginalized black community that surrounds Temple University. So when he was essentially fired, or he didn't have his contract renewed technically, but this is a de facto firing, considering that he had been there for 10 years, this created a big outrage among people who are familiar with the man and what he does there. For me personally, I knew him because I had seen him interviewed before. While I was at Temple, I'd come across interviews that he had done talking about Martin Luther King, Pan-Africanism, and W.E.B. Du Bois. And I thought that I was very happy that there was someone out there speaking about issues related to U.S. imperialism and the intertwined struggles of peoples in the third world, and especially black Americans. So whenever I was teaching at Temple, I taught classes on the history and significance of race and the politics of identity. I would show videos of Montero's interviews and sort of pair them with speeches from Martin Luther King and his talks about Vietnam, his speeches on Vietnam. And I found him to be a very eloquent, erudite scholar and someone who was really speaking truth to power, and you know, an example of just the kind of voices that we see less and less of, it seems. And so I didn't even personally know the man, and I met him only more recently. But when I heard that he was fired, I immediately tried to go to the rallies that were on his behalf and encourage any other friends of mine in academia to lend his support to the call for the reinstatement of Dr. Anthony Montero, because it just seems to be so, it's just such so emblematic of the bigger struggles that we have with the sort of truthfulness in the truth emergency, not just in the media, but in academia, where there's just no institutional support for people who want to speak truth to power.
Aaron, hi, this is Peter Phillips. As I'm reading the history of this case, and certainly Dr. Montero had been there for a decade, he was an activist in the community. The neighborhood around Temple is one of the poorest zip code areas in the entire United States. It's predominantly African American. And he's been very active in what's been called the black radical tradition. And he was very active in terms of supporting Mumia Abu-Jamal, which is very sensitive to the elites in Philadelphia. So is this a political firing? You know, he was put up for department chair, and then his dean wanted someone else. There was some internal haranguing going on. But is this a political firing that's really happening, and he's being dismissed even though he should have had tenure? His contract is not being renewed, and that's an overt dismissal. That's what it sounds like to us. Because he was radical, they're getting rid of him.
To be honest, that was my initial interpretation, and I think that there is likely some truth to that. It seems more apparent over time that the role of the current chair of the department, Asante, that he has a personal and ideological animosity towards Montero, and he has been working to change the entire department, even to change the name, as I understand it, to the Department of Africology, instead of the materialist and Pan-Africanist perspective of W.E.B. Du Bois, Kwame Nkrumah, and others. It's this Afrocentric perspective. It focuses less on the material material circumstances of African Americans, and is less focused upon, you know, the concrete realities of imperialism and the practices and the institutions of imperialism and neoliberalism. And so one starts to wonder how these things dovetail with each other, how these sort of perspectives, you know, gain more support and so on. On some level, Asante has come out and attacked Montero in ways that make it pretty clear that there is a personal ideological stake that he has in this. I mean, he has attacked him for being called him a charlatan and a low-level purveyor of Marxism and anti-African ideas. He's written things on his Facebook page that are strangely unprofessorial, I'll say, where he even says at one point he is not a Du Bois scholar or not a scholar of Du Bois, when even if you didn't find Montero's scholarship on Du Bois to be good or not, which I think that he is a very insightful scholar, but there's no arguing the fact that he is a scholar of Du Bois. I mean, it's just very strange. And the Afrocentric perspective is one that I'm not an expert on, but whereas other scholars of the Black radical tradition I find to be extremely insightful about, you know, the realities of the our civilization. So I can say that Martin Luther King's speeches towards the end of his life, especially on imperialism and so on, that these are some of the most eloquent assessments of the problems of our civilization and the crises within our civilization.
And they're more radical critiques. They go to the root of imperialism and the roots of the problems. And that seems to be what Professor Montero was also addressing in many of his classes.
Yes, exactly. And that's why I found him to be a very compelling person and a compelling figure and someone worth fighting for out there.
Aaron Good, your PhD student here at Temple University in Philadelphia. We only have a few minutes left in the segment, and I wanted to get around to academic freedom and the tenure process. Certainly Peter and I could speak to that, but he left the tenured job to come under the promise of tenure and just never got it. And of course, dangling tenure is one of the ways that administrations can not only control potential content and behavior and activities of professors, but, you know, it's also a way of having a larger pool of adjunct or contingent faculty who have no real job security, and it also is the case that they're paid far less.
This is definitely true, and it's difficult to see. It's hard to figure out how much of this is kind of social engineering in a way to sort of neuter the scholars in general, and how much is sort of profiteering, or if it's just some very unhappy synergy of the two of them.
Well, we certainly hear in the case of Asante, these kinds of attacks are incredibly uncollegial, unprofessional, and anti-intellectual. I mean, it's one thing to disagree, but there's definitely a campaign of personal attack against Dr. Montero. That seems to be evident in all the literature that I've seen on the subject. Listeners that are interested, there's a site called Educators for Momia Abu-Jamal, Image Online, emajonline.com, where there's a call for the reinstatement of Temple University's Dr. Anthony Montero. So if listeners are interested in finding out more about what some of the arguments are here, they can go and see the educator's response to this from May 15th of this month. Aaron, do you have any other websites or information to give us here as we close out the program today?
You gave the best one, and there is also a Justice for Dr. Anthony Montero Facebook page that I would also recommend.
Aaron Good, thank you for joining us from Temple University about this important issue on academic freedom. And you do good work yourself, the work you're doing with Lance DeHaven Smith, State Crimes Against Democracy, Deep Politics. We're going to have you back on to talk more about that another time.
Great. I look forward to it.
Thanks again, Aaron. You've been listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I am Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We'd love to thank our producer, Anthony Fest, and Erica Bridgman at the controls. The Project Censored Show airs on over a dozen stations around the United States. Archives can be found at projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook.